Hi, and welcome to episode 148 of the Sea Control podcast hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm the senior producer of Sea Control, Chris Lee, and this week, join us for an interview with Dr. Eric Grove, an established expert on the Royal Navy and author of prominent works such as Vanguard to Trident and the Royal Navy since 1815. In this episode, Dr. Grove provides us with an overview of modern British naval and maritime history, developments it's seen since the Cold War, and the nature of the course the Royal Navy charts today. We'll get started with this enlightening interview after a short word from our sponsor.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
Hello and moin moin, Center for International Maritime Security listeners. I am Roger Hilton, a non-resident academic fellow for the Institute for Security Policy at Keele University, welcoming you back for another edition of the Sea Control Series podcast. With the winter weather setting in, I hope you are all bundled up in your wetsuits. Great Britain is one of the few island civilizations that for centuries served as the center of a sprawling global empire. Obviously, this success would not have materialized without their prowess at sea. This mastery of everything maritime was captured perfectly in Peter Hopkirk's book, The Great Game, when Captain James Abbott explains the extent of territory and power of Queen Victoria to a Kievan tribal lord. A glance at the map, he said, he would show them that the seas occupied three times as much of the earth's surface as the land, adding that wherever the ocean rolls, there my queen has no rival. Here today to help us update the state of this mastery is Dr. Eric Grove. Dr. Grove is a commanding authority on naval history and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, a vice president and fellow of the Society for Nautical Research, and a member of the Council of Navy Record Society. In addition, he is author of Vanguard to Trident, the standard work on the post-1945 Royal Navy. Dr. Grove, welcome aboard today.
I'm very happy to be able to sort of talk with you on this very important subject.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. With so much of the media, both at home and abroad, focusing on the state of Brexit, it will certainly be refreshing to hear your thoughts about Stanhope to Zimbelis and the UK's naval strategy in the 21st century. So, let's jump right into it. Your piece begins by declaring your positivity about the state of the Royal Navy from the time of the Vienna Congress in 1815 to the beginning of the current century. Following the end of the Cold War in 1991, produced mixed results for the Royal Navy. On one hand, the concentration of resources and preoccupation with continental commitments of ground and air forces had ended, a positive in theory which you mention in your piece. In opposition, due to the peace dividend, the Royal Navy suffered serious cuts. Prior to reviewing the 1997 Strategic Defense Review, can you contextualize what those budget cuts meant for listeners?
Well, the Navy didn't suffer as much as the other services. In fact, the Army lost 120,000 people in the so-called options for change process, which some people criticized because it wasn't perhaps focused enough. The Navy lost about 60,000, but the cuts were limited. The number of frigates and destroyers came down from about 50, actually it was more like about 45, to about 40, which sadly turned out to be a little less than that. But the Navy on the whole was able to argue that in the new strategic circumstances, it should suffer least. Now, the continental commitment had been a tremendous, the commitment of ground and air forces to mainland Europe, had been a major factor in British defence policy throughout the Cold War. And the fact that that continental commitment, if not being abandoned, was being wound down, meant that the space, if you like, for the Royal Navy was actually rather greater in terms of the overall defence budget. So although there were cuts, they weren't as significant as they might have been. And one might say the priority of the Royal Navy overall in British defence policy increased.
Okay, well, thank you for bringing the prioritization of the Royal Navy to the forefront for the listeners. In 1997, the British people overwhelmingly elected Labour's Tony Blair. As you and I both know, his record has shown he was not shy on foreign policy.
Absolutely.
Immediately, his government commissioned the Strategic Defense Review, which you describe as a major triumph for the Royal Navy. Consequently, Labour's more interventionist-oriented foreign policy was greater than its predecessors of the Conservatives under John Major. Dr. Grove, in practical terms, what did the SDR mean for the Royal Navy? What are the positives and negatives that our listeners should recognize in such a complex document?
Well, the most important thing was the decision to purchase two large aircraft carriers. These were the only platforms actually mentioned in the introduction by Defence Secretary George Robertson to the review. As he put it, in the future, we can't expect the crisis to come to us, we have to go to the crisis. And so the two aircraft carriers were in there. Apparently, there'd been quite a lot of controversy right up to the publication of the review. We know a lot about this review because in those halcyon days of open government, they allowed the BBC in to do a fly-on-the-wall documentary. And there you see the carrier being very ably defended in perhaps a slightly unlikely Baltic scenario supporting an Eastern European country. So, going for the aircraft carrier and making the carrier the centrepiece of the future Navy was, I think, a major victory, although some would say it was putting a lot of eggs in those baskets. But on the other hand, it was a great success. The cuts to the surface fleet were kept limited and to submarines. And so it looked as if the era of continentalism was really over and that British strategy would have a maritime emphasis. They actually even asked the academics about this review. I went to a meeting in Coventry in the Midlands of England, as far north as the civil servants would let the government go without falling off the end of the world. And I said at one point, if you don't know who you're going to fight when and where, then maritime forces and maritime platforms are more important. And a junior defence minister nodded sagely. So I think I'd made my mark.
I mean, there's no doubt, and I think you would agree that Secretary of State Robertson was onto something when he said that you had to go to the crises rather than expect them. And as everybody would recognize, an aircraft carrier is the ultimate tour of power projection.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So much utility to it. Something that I found super interesting in your piece was how you mentioned the previous Whitehall defeats of 1966 and 1982 for the listeners. So maybe you can also elaborate on how the Navy overcame their previous Whitehall defeats from those periods.
Well, in 1966, there was a big argument between the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy as to what could do the East of Suez job, the job of intervening east of Suez in the Indian Ocean and Southeast Asian areas best as far as air power was concerned. And the Royal Navy was really out-argued by the Royal Air Force, whose apparent command of modern analytical techniques really impressed Defence Secretary Healy, who later said, in fact, that he'd been rather hoodwinked, but still. Then again in 1981, a Defence Secretary, John Knott, who'd been put in to bring the budget and the programme into greater congruence, lost faith in the power of the naval staff because he'd been told things in the United States about the future shape of the Battle of the Atlantic, and he believed the Americans rather than the Royal Navy. In fact, it was a time when strategy was changing towards the more forward strategy of the 1980s. But the Navy learnt they made staff training a much more important part of the training of all naval officers. They began to recognise that the Whitehall battle was as important as any battle, and perhaps more important than most. And by the late 90s, the Royal Navy had got rather good at arguing its corner within the Ministry of Defence. And I think, as I say, if you look at this TV programme, it's very interesting to see how well the naval officers are arguing and how positively. And the Royal Air Force and the civil servants are both on the defensive.
That's a positive for our listeners to know, knowing that into the future, the Royal Navy will be able to defend their positions adequately well and hopefully not suffer too many devastating budget cuts.
Better, but of course the balance shifts at various times, as we shall see later on.
Our listeners should get the popcorn, as the tensions between the rival factions is something out of theater. Dr. Grove, as the Royal Navy enters the new millennium, you claimed its new expeditionary strategy was justified and cite operations specifically in Sierra Leone that helped its stabilization as an example of proof. You subsequently identify then a watershed moment, the attacks of September 11th, as a negative turning point for the Royal Navy, as it led to the reemergence of a continental strategy. In fact, Europe was replaced with Asia, in your words. Before going into more detail, can you explain why Navy personnel loathed the concept of continental strategy?
Because it took attention away from what they regarded as the important dimensions of an island nation. An island nation needs a navy if it wants to protect itself and project power. And having to put so much emphasis on a major commitment of ground troops, not just troops, but their families as well. Back in 81, there was a major conflict between the First Sea Lord and the Ministry of Defence, who wanted to say, well, why not bring the families home? It will save a great deal of money. Although actually, bringing the families home and trying to find facilities for them in Britain, and even more so bringing the troops home, would actually have spent money rather than saved it. But in general, the Royal Navy disliked very much being tied down to a sort of a single threat in Germany, and largely a land and air threat in Germany, rather than a more substantial global threat. And you can see in the writings of people like Admiral Richard Hill, for example, one of the leading thinkers of the Navy at the time, a considerable frustration that the continent was taking resources away from a more balanced strategic policy.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt you make a very compelling argument in your submission about how at the time the British defense policy was unbalanced. But if it was disadvantaged against the Royal Navy, who was it favoring in charge of? Specifically, was it the military or the Air Force?
Well, both. It was the Army and the Air Force. There was both a land and air contribution. It was certainly helping the Army. The Army was able very easily to argue its case because it had, a 200-kilometer section of the Central Front. It knew precisely who it was going to fight. It had a very good idea of what it needed. And actually, it increased the sophistication of its doctrine. It invented the concept of doctrine in British defense circles in the later Cold War period. The Air Force, too, one needed a considerable contribution of aircraft as well. And so this became the priority. And one saw it, in fact, particularly in the 1981 the Defence Review, the John Knott Defence Review, where, in fact, the Atlantic commitment, the Chief of Staff had tried very hard in the 70s, under pressure from the Defence Reviews then, to come up with what were called the four pillars of British defence policy. But certainly it seemed in 1981 that the land and air contribution to Central Europe was considered to be much more important than the contribution to the North Atlantic. And that was something that, naturally, the gentleman in dark blue didn't like.
If we did a quick counterfactual exercise, Dr. Grove, if September 11th had never happened, how do you think the Royal Navy would look today?
I think it would look somewhat larger. I think we would have kept a carrier capability throughout the century so far. We wouldn't have done away with the carriers as they were later done away with, thankfully temporarily. I think it would be relatively larger. And I think given the kind of operations that might have occurred, such as Sierra Leone, which I think we'll be coming back to, I think that in these circumstances, if strategic circumstances had stayed the same, we'd have more frigates and destroyers, we'd have perhaps a marginally larger attack submarine force, and we certainly would not have abandoned carriers as we did temporarily in the 2010s.
Forgive me, but I have to ask this question then, but if your desired wish to have an expanded Navy had materialized, how do you think that would have influenced British foreign policy in terms of being able to go to more crisis-oriented situations, or what would be the real impact on the drafting of foreign policy?
Well, we might have done more in Africa. I mean, I think one of the trends in the very early years of the 21st century were operations in Africa. And I think even the operations then were seen to be sort of stretching the armed forces somewhat. And I think, therefore, there may have been perhaps a more gently interventionist policy, shall we say, in various parts of the world where British governments were trying to intervene as a force for good, which was what they used to say. And of course, we have the Blair doctrine of humanitarian intervention. Whether that might have backfired badly is, of course, something we can't say. But I think what did certainly happen was that the commitment to Iraq and to Afghanistan greatly helped the army in its pressure to make the army the major service, and in fact almost come up with a cultural change where the media began to refer to servicemen as soldiers.
No doubt the pursuant of very sought-after financial resources was extremely buoyed by both the interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, but hopefully as we move forward, you can elaborate on if England is in fact losing its island nation ethos, which is the linchpin to Great Britain's great success in the past.
Well, you could say it's the opposite now. I mean, you mentioned at the start about Brexit, but in fact, actually, you might argue that our desire to leave the European community or European Union is in fact part of Britain redefining its position as a sort of a second rank, not second rate, but second rank global power. So I think that some future historians might see a sort of secular trend taking place of Britain repositioning itself as a more global power. And so, perhaps we're in the middle of some great historic trend. But certainly that should help the Navy somewhat. But of course, the budgetary pressures remain, very considerable.
I couldn't agree with you more, though. But as Great Britain ventures out into the unknown abyss at the moment, I think you would be in agreement that the Navy will only start to gain more prevalence if they're trying to reposition themselves as a second rank global power with access to world markets.
That's right, yes. I mean, perhaps, we need to go back and look at Admiral Richard Hill's, he died recently, sadly, his book Medium Rank Naval Powers, because I think that is certainly the role which Britain wished to fulfill. The British still considered themselves to be a world power, if not a superpower. And if they want to be so, then certainly maritime forces are very important. Now, Whether, in fact, the Navy will get the resources to do that, given the balance of, shall we say, political power within the Ministry of Defence or within the armed services, is a moot point. I think Cameron had been converted to a born-again sea power man by the time he resigned. The position of the present government, well, of course, is so preoccupied with other things, it's hard to say.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, there's so much uncertainty, but I mean, some of the wild theories about substituting the European trade I've even read about is Great Britain potentially joining NAFTA. And you have a very sympathetic regime, or should I say administration, with President Trump. So obviously, with such great logistical issues, the Navy will once again play a major role in any facilitation of capital and goods.
Well, I think once the carriers come into service, I mean, I think people will be quite surprised, actually, at the potential of Britain's maritime forces. The problem is, of course, are the RAF really wholeheartedly behind the idea of the joint force? I mean, one reason the carrier came along back in 1998 was because there was a cordat, if you like, between the RAF and the Navy to set up Joint Force 2000, as it originally was, Joint Force Harrier, as it became. And, you know, they haven't come up with a name for it, but, of course, the first squadron, 617 Squadron Royal Air Force, the Dambusters number, is, in fact, a joint RAF naval affair. But there's only one squadron. And as some critics have said, we have this wonderful carrier, which looks marvellous. And I was on board her recently, and she is marvellous. But, you know, what about her aircraft? Now, she's going to go to the Far East in 2020 with a combined British and American group, which goes right back to the origins of the carrier, actually, that in fact the idea was it would give Britain a say in the actions of a joint force air component commander. So having a combined air group on board is actually a very important thing. And this, of course, brings in another dimension. The Royal Navy as, shall we say, part of the cement in the Anglo-American strategic relationship.
Outstanding, the cement. I like that quite a bit, Dr. Grove. We've swerved off topic a little bit with the wings.
Sorry.
No, it's fascinating stuff. As we veer back on, 9 years on for 9/11, the British government was occupied by a conservative, liberal, Democrat coalition led by David Cameron and Nick Clegg. Outside of its borders, as we've already mentioned and discussed, the UK was firmly involved in both Afghanistan and Iraq, which, as history has shown, did not go according to plan. To compound problems, a wave of economic decline through the Great Recession was sweeping Europe and North America. Against the backdrop of this coalition government, it undertook, as what you described, a hurried Strategic Defense and Security Review, SDSR. To begin with, can you clarify the difference between an SDSR and an SDR?
Well, the idea was, in principle, that in fact one should look at national security policy in the round, and a National Security Council was set up to try to come up with a policy which made more sense. Unfortunately, the lead was quite clearly the Treasury. They couldn't afford everything. And as I said at the time, the army wrapped itself in its Afghan blanket that proved to be extremely effective and kept it nice and warm, and the other armed services paid the price, particularly the Navy. I remember my late wife coming into the bedroom on the night of the review and saying, "Eric, they're scrapping Ark Royal." And I couldn't believe it, because right up to the end of that review, and it demonstrates the sort of disconnect between higher security policy and the actual defence posture and the budgeting for it, right up to the end of that, it looked as if the Harriers, the short takeoff and vertical landing Harriers operating from the aircraft carrier, Ark Royal at the time, would survive, and that the land-based Tornadoes would go. But there was, right at the end of the review, a serious counterattack by the chief of the defence staff, a senior RAF officer, and would you believe, a Tornado officer, who convinced the government that it should be the Harriers that should go, without necessarily telling the Prime Minister, so rumour would have it, that in fact that would mean the end of the aircraft carrier. But once they were committed to the demise of the Harrier, and this was a problem, of course, because the joint force had put the RAF in the driving seat as far as the carrier air groups were concerned, and they decided on their own priorities they wanted to keep the Tornado, and so the Harriers went, and the carrier capability went also, because officially it was estimated that there would not be a requirement for aircraft carriers in the next 10 years or so. Things didn't turn out quite that way.
I mean, to think that carriers are never needed is a bit of a farcical proposition, from my perspective at least.
But it was an overambitious one.
But based on everything you just said then, what was the major takeaway for the Royal Navy based on the hurried SDSR? Was it the takeaway of the Ark Royal, or was it the last-minute pressure to keep the Tornadoes?
Well, as far as they were concerned, it was the loss of Ark Royal. It came as a big surprise. Now, the current commanding officer of HMS Ark Royal was the last commanding, of HMS Queen Elizabeth, our new aircraft carrier, which is coming into service, was the last captain of HMS Ark Royal. And he learned on the news that his ship was going to be decommissioned. which only goes to show the hurried nature of the final decisions of the review. And it was the loss of the carrier that was the important thing. Yes, the submarine force would be retained to a very large extent, marginal reduction from 8 to 7. New submarines would come into service. The nuclear deterrent was to stay. At that period, the amphibious force, although it was, you know, to be reduced, one of the amphibious transport docks would go into reserve. But nonetheless, you know, the rest of the Navy, on the whole, suffered not quite so badly as perhaps it might have done. But the real loss was the loss of the aircraft carrier, the loss of carrier strike. And this caused a tremendous, the fleet air arm, certainly the air component of the Navy, it caused a tremendous, well, a neo-revolutionary feeling, as I found when I gave an after-dinner speech down at Yeovilton, the Naval Air Station, shortly afterwards. I've never seen a more mutinous bunch of young officers in my life.
Mutinous is the perfect word to describe where we're heading next, Dr. Grove. You make no effort in your piece to hide your disappointment about the paradoxical commitments to power projection based on the 2011 defense planning assumptions.
That's right, absolutely.
And now for our listeners, the real palace intrigue starts. Can you elaborate on the tensions between the Army, Navy against the RAF, and specifically the role of the famous Tornado Mafia?
Well, yes, I mean, the Tornado Force, the sort of long-range strike force, is very close to the soul, one might say, almost, of the Royal Air Force. The Royal Air Force in the 1920s acquired strategic bombing as its major role. It was their major offensive capability in the Second World War, to which virtually all else gave way. It was the nuclear delivery system for a long time. In fact, I think the RAF has never quite forgiven the Navy for taking over the nuclear delivery role. It was one reason they were so determined to hang on to limited war air power in the east of Suez in the carrier controversy of the 1960s. And so the RAF have tended to emphasize certain aspects of air power, leaving maritime air power, naval air power, in the hands of the Navy. Now, in fact, the Navy wanted, back in the 60s, something rather like the current joint force. And they offered a partnership with the Air Force and carrier-based aircraft. But the Air Force turned that down because it wanted to use the East of Suez scenario for its long-range land-based jets. And that, of course, is what the Air Force really believes in. Now, if the only way they're going to get, say, F-35 aircraft is to actually go along with the Navy and go along with the government in the joint force, well and good. But certainly as late as the SDSR in 2011, they put the maintenance of their Tornado force way above their contribution to Britain's carrier force. And if that meant the end of the carrier force, so what?
Thank you for sort of explaining a little bit of the inner tensions within the defense establishment. Another point that you raised regarding the 2011 defense planning assumptions is the role of BAE, specifically if a hiatus in building would mark the end of the industry. Could you comment a little bit on, within the procurement realm about the significance of what that would mean for BAE and for future carriers?
This is very important, actually, because the government at that time was so against carriers. Basically, Cameron and the Conservatives in particular saw the carrier program as a nasty Labour job creation scheme. And they wanted, in fact, given a perfect world, to cancel the second carrier. Or, in fact, if not that, put the first carrier into reserve and build the second one. But they were certainly playing with the idea of cancelling the second carrier. And the chairman of BAE, sponsored, I think, by the Navy to some extent, wrote to the Prime Minister and said, look, if you scrap the second carrier, if you don't build it, there isn't going to be a shipbuilding industry because BAE will have to lay off most of its shipbuilders. You say you want a new frigate, but that's not going to be developed for in time to maintain the workforce. Basically, if you scrap the second carrier, you will destroy the British warship building industry, indeed the British shipbuilding industry. And the government could hardly, or that letter was leaked, it was certainly published, and the government could hardly do anything else but keep the carrier Prince of Wales. The idea originally being that Prince of Wales would be the ship brought into service, and what would happen to Queen Elizabeth? Well, she might be put into reserve, etc. That actually didn't happen. But certainly the main reason that the second carrier was returned, the fact that the carrier force was retained, was basically industrial rather than strategic. It wasn't, as many people say, that cancelling the ship would have cost more than building it. That's not the case. The real point was that if you cancelled HMS Prince of Wales, the second aircraft carrier, you would cease to have a warship building industry.
Without being over dramatic, it is somewhat of an apocalyptic situation for Great Britain not to have a shipbuilding industry. What would the alternative have been in the defence policy if Great Britain did not possess an organic shipbuilding industry then?
Well, it would certainly create a lot of unemployment along the Clyde, And given the fact the carrier was also being built on the Tyne and on the River Mersey and down at Appledore, it would have created considerable unemployment, and that would have been politically unwelcome. BAE would have continued building jet fighters, although this is a whole new issue which we can't go into about the future of the Typhoon and so on. But certainly BAE also have got in on the F-35 program. One tends to forget that a significant part of the F-35 is built actually in Lancashire, in the northwest of England. So BAE would have continued, but certainly, I think it was the jobs implications, the fact that BAE would have had to have laid off most of its shipbuilding people, and this would have led to considerable social problems and indeed political problems. It might have made the Scottish Nationalists even more powerful than they became.
Outside of the social issues that you just described in detail, would the other areas of the British defence policy be able to pick up the slack with a massive diminishment in British Navy?
Not so much shipbuilding. No, I mean, nowadays, British shipbuilding depends very much on warships. The carrier program has been a tremendous fillip for the shipbuilding industry. I always say when I talk about it, you know, it's not just a, you know, expenditure on the ship. There's been investment, for example, on the Cannel Lairds, which has allowed them to take on extra work, major shipbuilder on the Mersey. It's been a tremendous investment in skills and so on in British industry. And in fact, not for the first time, naval policy has been governed, perhaps is too strong a word, but strongly influenced by the industrial factors. Way back in 1908, there was a crisis. We want 8 battleships and we won't wait. That was to get the private shipbuilders to invest in shipbuilding capacity. During the 1920s and 30s, great concerns about the decline of the shipbuilding industry and building ships. In the 1970s, the major factor in labour building as many ships as it did in the 1970s, and was quite a boom then, was to keep the shipbuilders in work. So in fact, this sort of interplay between naval policy and industrial and social policy is very important.
So thank you again for the various options that came with the 2011 defence planning assumptions. After being obstructed for a considerable time by the Tornado Mafia, you praise the 2011 edition of the British Maritime Doctrine. For our policy wonks out there, it is JDP0-10. It's first released since the mid-1990s. Can you run the listeners through how the document represented the natural evolution per the wisdom of Sir Julian Colbert and his belief in the role of navies in affecting what happened ashore?
Well, yes. I mean, I was involved actually in the first edition of Maritime Doctrine. I was a co-author way back in the 1990s. And in fact, in the latest issue, my own ideas, which I developed in Future of Sea Power, my sort of triangle of naval roles, you know, warfighting, constabulary and diplomatic have been developed there. But yes, I mean, Corbett is very much the sort of the origin, really, of modern British maritime strategic thought. His idea of command of the sea being something for limited periods of time and in limited areas chimes in very well with the doctrine of sea control, which the Americans developed in the 1970s and which is now, you know, standard naval thinking around the world. The idea of, well, he called it in 1911, you know, the mounting of expeditions. We'd call it power projection now. And he also his emphasis, which is perhaps the most important thing, that in fact one needs to think of a maritime strategy and not just a naval one. A naval one is almost incidental to using the sea as an important strategic factor, supporting troops ashore, supplying them, might not necessarily be actually Marines, but as he said in some principles of maritime strategy, the Navy's main role is what it allows your, or a major role of the Navy is what it allows your army to do. So therefore, the idea that there was an overall maritime strategy that Britain could pursue, in some ways he was defeated. He was trying in the pre-First World War period to avoid, we go back to it, a continental strategy. As things turned out, we couldn't do that, or we didn't do it. But certainly the idea of naval power being part of a joint maritime strategy, the fact that there should be an emphasis on the sea as an area from which one deploys forces ashore, the idea of power projection, very important. He didn't say so much about the peacetime roles of naval power, although he does at times refer to the policing functions of certain ships and this kind of thing, which we now call maritime security, the constabulary role. But certainly in his balanced way of looking at maritime strategy, the fact in a sense he took Clausewitz to sea, including Clausewitz's ideas on limited war, etc., was a very sophisticated foundation for the development of British naval thought in the 20th and into the 21st century, and something that I certainly and my colleagues who have produced doctrine over the years have tended to emphasize.
Clausewitz at sea, that's a first, Dr. Rowe. That was great. For our listeners, in case you're a little bit interested, Corbett's most famous work is Some Principles of Maritime Strategy, which I think you'll agree, Dr. Rowe, remains a classic among students of naval warfare.
Absolutely. I, in fact, produced the United States Naval Institute edition in the Classics of Naval Strategy series with my own introduction and footnotes, etc. That's not an advertisement, but I think it's still available. And certainly, I mean, I argued in that uniquely, I think, better than anyone else, including Mahan, Corbett was able to tease out from the experiences of the past lessons and principles, perhaps, for current and future application. And that really was his genius.
And just correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Grove, but Some Principles of Maritime Strategy was published in 1908, right?
1911.
So for our listeners, I'm going to read out Corbett's four concepts, and it's striking how applicable they are today. So number one, controlling lines of communications, focus on the enemy, and maneuver for tactical advantage. Number two, the aspects of political, economic, and financial dimensions of waging war, as well as with the technological and material aspects of war. Number three, the primary of politics in war and in devising an appropriate strategy to protect the national interests.
And that's Clausewitz, yes.
Yeah. And number four, the emphasis on efficiency in battle while preserving costly assets. That fourth one is interesting, as if a budget was around the corner for him and he had to do a little bit of bootstrapping.
Well, he wasn't. Concerned about the Mahanian idea that you must fight a battle at all costs. This, of course, leads us into the arguments, which we can't get into in detail, about the Battle of Jutland, how far Corbett was responsible for the, perhaps some might argue, rather timid and non-aggressive approach of the Royal Navy at the Battle of Jutland. Certainly people at the time said he was, as I made clear in my introduction to my edition back in 88. And certainly the fact that you don't go into a headlong rush. In fact, he was rather critical of Nelson. He was enough of a heretic to be that, for the headlong rush at Trafalgar. He thought that modern warships were too much of a national investment for to be risked like that.
Fascinating stuff. We're a bit off topic, but getting back to the British maritime doctrine, Dr. Grove.
Yes.
Its definition in terms of maritime power projection was wide-ranging in utility, and more importantly, addressed the strategic needs of the security landscape. Based on your expertise, can you address how maritime security was provided for where UK interests needed protection? And for our listeners, maybe you could provide some examples to illustrate your point.
Do you mean the concept of maritime security as part of the threefold role, if you see what I mean, rather than maritime security in a broader sense?
No, I mean, I think it's much more of the refined sphere I was referring to.
Well, maritime security, of course, British contributions to evacuating nationals from various places, various times, from Lebanon, for example, in relatively recent years, dealing with anti-piracy operations. In fact, there was this great growth of piracy, and this led to the Royal Navy playing a leading role in dealing with it, developing tactics such as fast boarding and this kind of thing. In fact, it might be argued that piracy and also anti-drug operations became the main roles of the Royal Navy for a time, actually, in the 21st century. And the maritime security role came to predominate. This led to a debate about whether one needed sophisticated frigates and destroyers to take part in these operations. So maritime security in the broadest sense, particularly with the possibility of terrorism at sea, which I always thought was a threat that was hyped a bit too much. But nonetheless, you know, keeping good order at sea became perhaps the predominant role of the Royal Navy for most of the 21st century so far, although that is changing now.
I mean, everything you said is right on. When you refer to these, the British Maritime Doctrine refers to these as benign operations. And like you said, in terms of humanitarian, the British assistance during disaster relief operations after the Indian Ocean tsunami. And again, with the trends in climate change, rising sea levels, and the very, very frequent environmental disasters that have occurred, I think we're both in agreement that the Navy will have to play much more of a dual role in this type of operation in addition to power projection.
Absolutely. Well, of course, one of the arguments in favor of the aircraft carrier is that it's a box that floats. and it could be used for anything. And certainly I've noticed that the naval spokesman have been arguing the case for, as you say, the benign role, which in a sense you can differentiate perhaps from constabulary in the broadest sense. The constabulary is the application of laws, perhaps using a certain amount of force within a mandate, etc. Benign is, as you say, a disaster relief and so on. That's a term we invented, actually, in our original edition of British Maritime Doctrine back in the 90s. But yes, these broad roles, and in fact, warships, including the biggest, including the carrier, are being justified very much in terms of disaster relief and so on. And it's not special pleading. These are the kinds of things, the things that float and have space and can operate helicopters and have medical facilities, all the things warships do are crucial for.
Another asset outlined in the British Maritime Doctrine was a more traditional role, which was Britain's international engagement, as in the aim to prevent conflict from emerging. Can you elaborate in theory and in practice what the concept of conflict prevention from the Royal Navy actually means?
It's the ability to sort of deploy forces on a contingent basis, perhaps visibly, perhaps not, so that measures can be taken in due time to deter action and or control action should it occur. One thinks of perhaps the operations of the British aircraft carrier in the Adriatic in the 1990s, which I had the privilege of seeing when I was writing something for Ark Royal and I was on board her, and having a contingent force in the ship to actually support the peacekeeping force ashore should that get into trouble. We always try to be within range of the army ashore. So as a contingency force, hopefully in fact flying overhead to deter and prevent people who might want to interfere with the activities of the UN Protection Force. Poise is a British maritime term. Poise to protect, as Ark Royal liked to say. So you can keep something poised in international waters where you can move, but you can also produce a graduated, potentially forceful response ashore. You don't want to use force if you can avoid it, so that you can help control and stabilize what goes on ashore. You can see it too in Operation Palliser, the Sierra Leone operation in 2000, perhaps the most successful of Mr. Blair's wars, where in fact you brought in naval forces, maritime forces. These could land troops, these could provide troops ashore, they could support them, and they could also overfly and deter the Sierra Leonean rebels and others in the hugely sort of disorganized affair ashore from interfering with the British, because if they did, they might suffer air attack. We didn't have to carry out the air attacks, but the deterrent threat was there.
That's a perfect segue, Dr. Wu, because staying within the international engagement asset role, let's take a trip back in time and discuss deterrence. I think you would agree that looking back at history is sometimes the best way to speculate on the future, especially since deterrence as a contemporary concept has been resurrected due to the deteriorating European security landscape for numerous reasons.
Quite so.
As you know, new prime ministers are asked to write letters of last resort on their first day in office, which are sealed and given to captains of the UK's nuclear submarines in the event that the government is wiped out by nuclear strike. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn is on record as saying nuclear weapons are not the solution to the world's security issues. They are a disaster if ever used. We spoke about it very, very lightly already, but can you describe the primary function of strategic deterrence at sea within the UK framework?
Well, basically, Britain deploys at all times one nuclear-powered ballistic missile-firing submarine with a number, it's apparently 8 missiles on board, with up to 40 warheads on board. These provide a range of potential nuclear responses. One suspects that about 2 of the missiles have single warheads, one with a low-yield warhead, one with a high-yield warhead, and the rest carry multiple independently targetable re-entry vehicles. This gives you a spectrum of potential responses, which any potential enemy should know about. And it deters everything from, at one level, the use of chemical weapons against British forces in the field to a full-scale nuclear attack on the United Kingdom. One imagines that, in fact, it would only be in very extreme circumstances that nuclear weapons might be used, and hence the letters of last resort. What Mr. Corbyn would write, heaven knows. But, of course, one doesn't know what's in there, and one hope would any potential aggressor would, in fact, take the worst possible solution. And it's interesting, too. I mean, how a captain would react if Britain had been knocked out, and or apparently. They monitor the long-wave Radio 4 programmes, actually, apparently, as a sign of, you know, what's been happening, and if they disappear. here something has gone dreadfully wrong. So, yes, I mean, at the top end of all this deterrence, you have the deterrent force. And Britain remains, despite the attitude of a small number of people in the Labour Party, committed to maintaining a deterrent. There is a new so-called successor class of submarines. The first is called HMS Dreadnought. The other, which is currently under construction just over the way from where I live in the northwest of England. And there are going to be three more. Probably three, perhaps two, but I expect a total force of four. Each will carry up to 12 missiles, and they will retain the capability in close cooperation with the United States, but with totally independent British operational control.
I mean, no doubt, in the event that Jeremy Corbyn ever was elected, it would definitely have a major impact on sort of the Trident delivery system. And as well, even without Corbyn in power, the Scottish Nationals, as you know, are very much against the nuclear posture of Great Britain. Complementary to strategic deterrence is conventional deterrence, which has risen in respectability, according to your professional assessment, since the 1990s. Can you start by distinguishing the difference for our listeners between strategic deterrence and conventional deterrence, and explain why maritime forces are particularly well-suited to conventional deterrence?
Right, well, strategic deterrence is basically considered to be fundamentally nuclear, and that you have a secure second strike capability in your submarine. This cannot be taken out by a potential opponent, and it gives you a set of nuclear options, including full-scale Armageddon, if Britain suffers nuclear attack. Conventional forces, of course, play a part in an overall deterrent strategy. Certainly they did in the days of the Cold War, because the idea was you started fighting at the conventional level, and then perhaps you might escalate in a controlled kind of way. And the Trident force can still do that, or used to be called sub-strategic capability, but now I think that's a little out of fashion, as any use of nuclear weapons would be strategic. As far as conventional is concerned, yes, demonstrating to a potential opponent that if they engage in some kind of operation, they will face a conventional response which might well defeat that operation. The best example of this, perhaps, was back in the early 70s when HMS Ark Royal flew its aircraft over Belize to try and prevent an invasion coming, because it was thought there might be, and the thought of having to operate against a strong force of buccaneers and phantoms rather put the buccaneers in particular, rather put the potential aggressors off. So having a capacity, and of course maritime forces can be brought to bear extremely effectively. The RAF would have had great difficulties in doing anything over Belize because it was out of range. But bringing the aircraft within range of the potential target is what maritime platforms can do. And that's the basic argument in favor of Britain having a carrier capability being restored in the 2020s.
Your example illustrates perfectly, as you said in the piece, that conventional deterrence is basically the UK government's most versatile military means.
Absolutely, yes.
The last major asset per the British maritime doctrine that you describe is the concept of presence as a multiplier of UK influence. The very famous first Sea Lord, Mark Stanhope, acutely recognized the benefit of this concept, which still stands today. Can you elaborate on this concept and integrate it into the 2003 Operation Keeling that took place in Sierra Leone while the invasion of Iraq was ongoing?
Yes, I mean, presence in general is having a force in the area and making it known. In fact, I've just marked a PhD thesis, very interesting, which argued that in fact there was a fundamental concept in the idea of visibility. Having maritime forces that can be brought to bear and being visible greatly enhances deterrence. Of course, to some extent, you can have a deterrent force which might be there or might not be there, hence the importance of submarines. Having a capacity to be there can be important. I mean, you could argue the Falklands War broke out because we were doing away with our naval presence in the area. It wasn't very powerful in itself, HMS Endurance, the ice patrol ship, but it was an important intelligence gatherer, and announcing it was going to be withdrawn gave the Argentines the impression that, in fact, we were not serious about defending the Falklands, and the invasion went ahead. So having some kind of naval capability in the area as a mark of national interest and national commitment is very, very important.
Prior to getting into the specifics of Operation Keeling, I just want to tell the listeners that the Sierra Leone Civil War began in March of 1991 when the Revolutionary United Front, with the support of special forces of Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Front of Liberia, intervened in Sierra Leone in an attempt to overthrow the Joseph Momo government. The resulting civil war lasted 11 years and left over 50,000 dead. So, Dr. Grove, how does Operation Keeling fit in with the concept of presence with Sierra Leone?
I think, in a way, the important thing in Sierra Leone was that Firstly, we showed a willingness to intervene, and then, by deploying ships, we showed a continuous willingness to intervene in the area to help stabilize things. And I think that that is the important thing. If you are in the area, and if you can bring forces to bear in the area, and if you have shown also a demonstrated a capacity, albeit in a limited way, to use force ashore, as we did in Sierra Leone, then I think that it can act as a very important stabilizing influence. It didn't solve the Sierra Leone problem, but certainly it prevented a victory by the RUF, who were the rebels, that could have had disastrous consequences, both in terms of what happened in Sierra Leone and in what it indicated to those elements, such as the Liberian government at the time, who wanted to sort of pursue their highly selfish interests.
No, it speaks volume to the effectiveness of the strategy that while it didn't end, it at least prevented more bloodshed.
Absolutely.
Fast forward, the National Security Strategy and Strategic Defense Security Review of 2015 was published and outlined the United Kingdom's defense strategy up to 2025. The National Security Risk Assessment of 2015 found the threats faced by the UK, including its overseas territories and overseas interests, have increased in scale, diversity, and complexity since 2010. It highlighted four particular threats that are likely to be priorities for UK security in the coming decade. They are, number one, increasing threat posed by terrorism, extremism, and instability, the resurgence of state-based threats, the impact of technology, especially cyber threats, and the erosion of rules-based international order, making it harder to build consensus and tackle global threats. Based against the litany of threats as outlined by the National Security Risk Assessment, can you contextualize the 2015 SDSR within a maritime context?
Yes, I mean, I think those were actually quite good in a way. I mean, I think they said that the terrorist threat was most likely, which of course is true. Of course, we have suffered terrorist attacks. But the important thing, I think, was to say the second one, that in fact, an increasing confrontation at a rather more traditional level with powers, you can't mention it, but particularly Russia and so on. Cyber warfare, very important. And of course, there has been investment in that. But in the maritime side, it demonstrates that we have to reorientate ourselves away from a primarily constabulary-based navy, or a navy that was doing primary constabulary roles, back towards a more traditional warfighting role. The Russian submarines are out again in the Atlantic. I was down at the Fleet Air Arm Station at Culdrose recently, the anti-submarine helicopter headquarters, and the captain there was saying a major preoccupation is keeping an eye on Russian submarines. Of course, our problem there, or one of the problems, is that in 2010, we did away with our maritime patrol fixed-wing aircraft, and it'll take time for this capability to be restored. They're operated by the RAF, but they're part of our maritime capability. The carrier force, very important. I've been engaged in some discussions about the possibility of going back to something like forward maritime strategy. And, of course, the number of American carriers might not be sufficient. So having a contribution to a forward carrier force and also amphibious forces for use on the northern flank, very important. Operations in the Baltic, operations in the Mediterranean, and of course, depending on the relationship of China with its neighbours and the East China Sea, given the fact that Mr. Trump has been making some rather conciliatory noises, it's interesting that the carrier is going to go to the Far East, partly, I think, for diplomatic reasons, but also partly to show that we can help strategically there. So, in fact, in the changing environment, going back to the future and having a more warfighting navy is important. There are question marks about the new frigate program, the new lighter frigate, which will be marvellous for the constabulary role. Perhaps we ought to have enough capability to be able to carry out higher level operations. But certainly the trend, and whenever I go to the Staff College and see the junior naval officers there, I argue this case very strongly. We have to go back to an expertise on anti-submarine warfare, an expertise in anti-air warfare, anti-surface ship warfare, all these various dimensions of warfighting. And this is something that is going to have to come back. It's priority two. It's perhaps less likely, but on the other hand, it is much more likely than it used to be.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. With all of the threats that are posed by the new technologies and cyber penetration, it's sometimes easy to forget about the validity about going back to basics in terms of protecting interests and projecting power.
That's right.
Finally, prior to the 2015 SDSR, you praised the development of strategic tripod of roles to develop the size, shape, and capabilities of the future British fleet, as outlined by First Sea Lord Admiral George Zimbalist. They are, number one, continuous sea deterrence, continuous carrier strike, and continuous amphibious readiness. To support these core capabilities and meet the requirement of its international engagements, a new generation of surface combats was called for. To date, has the introduction of the tripod system met or fallen short of your professional expectations?
Well, if we could keep it, it would be good, but continuous amphibious readiness is looking a little threadbare at the moment. The Ministry of Defence has been going through a serious cost-cutting process. In fact, the mine countermeasures force has been reduced, not actually with the types of mine countermeasure ships that the Navy wanted to keep. It was just convenient to scrap two. You know, one had lost its crew and the other was about to be refitted. This demonstrates the problem of budgetary constraints and budgetary pressures into line with coherence to strategic and operational planning. And it has been reported in the press, although it has been denied as being a final decision, that in fact the two amphibious transport docks might be taken out of service. One currently is in reserve, one is in service. This would be a tremendous blow to the amphibious capability of the UK and of the Western Alliance. So continuous amphibious readiness that always seemed to be a little bit of an add-on, although it had proved to be crucially important in the post-Cold War period, that appears to be under something of a cloud at the moment. A continuous carrier strike, fine, continuous at sea deterrence. But the problem is there enough budget to do all three things properly? And the answer is perhaps not, and that is the challenge. But we must, in fact, finesse together strategic and operational thinking and the shape and size of the fleet. There are signs that that is proving difficult at the moment, so we'll watch this space.
Well, based on your answer, it seems as if that the tripod system is meeting expectations but is unrealistic in application due to the limitation of funds to sufficiently finance all of these operations as set out by First Sea Lord Admiral George Zimbelis. Dr. Grove, based on our conversation, it goes without saying that the ability for the UK to continue to project power beyond its borders and respond to challenges of the 21st century will be dependent on Westminster being able to find and utilize a dynamic Royal Navy. Against the backdrop of Brexit, it goes without saying this is true. As we submerge on another Sea Control series podcast, do you have any operational takeaways for the listeners or issues related to the UK's naval strategy that we should keep our eye on moving forward?
Well, I think watch out, first of all, for how far the air groups of the carriers are going to reflect the proper operational requirement, which is 36 aircraft. There might be two American squadrons and one British squadron. We don't get another British squadron until I think 2022. But certainly the carrier strike capacity is so central that it needs to be properly serviced. There may be, some people in high positions have said, an increase in the strength of the Royal Navy because of the new cheaper Type 31E frigate or super corvette. Watch this space. Are we going to have these ships put into service faster than the rather more capable Type 26 ships? Are we going to maintain 19 frigates and destroyers, or are we going to increase? Are we going to maintain the nuclear-powered submarine force with its cruise missiles? The answer is probably yes. How far, though, will the nuclear deterrent program eat into the rest of the Navy? I ended my book, Vanguard to Trident, with some considerable worries about the impact of the Trident force on the rest of the Navy. I have become a somewhat born-again Trident man, but unless the government is willing to spend more on defence, and that depends very much on the economic results of Brexit, positively or negatively, then we are going to have a crisis and we won't be able to do everything we want to do. But that's been the name of the game in defence policy in general and naval policy in particular ever since the end of the Second World War and probably before it.
So a note to all of you Brexit followers, when you need a break from negotiations, be sure to follow all of Dr. Grove's suggestions. Once again, Dr. Grove, it was a pleasure hearing from you today, and I want to thank you for graciously passing on some of your wisdom and insight.
Pleasure, pleasure.
If our listeners want to follow up on the UK naval strategy or desire a better outlook of the general maritime domain, the Rutledge Handbook of Naval Strategy and Security, edited by Sebastian Bruns and Joachim Klaus, published in 2016, is an indispensable resource to have. In addition, please visit www.keelseapowerseries.com for more info on the book and other podcasts derived from the book. Dr. Grove, you were at the Keel Sea Power Series. Do you have a quick comment for our listeners on it?
It was very useful, and a very useful talk and a very useful meeting. And in fact, I'm very pleased that, in fact, such high-level discussions on such an important matter are taking place. Keel, of course, is in the Baltic. And that's a whole different story, but you never know. We have thought of sending carriers there in the past. You never know. We might do it in the future.
Well, with no shortages of maritime issues, as Dr. Grove has echoed, within the greater geopolitical landscape, I will be back to keep SimSec listeners well informed. From the Institute for Security Policy at Keele University and its adjunct Center for Maritime Strategy and Security, I am Roger Hilton, saying farewell and auf Wiedersehen.
That concludes episode 148 of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Chris Lee, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guest this week, Dr. Eric Grove, and interviewer Roger Hilton of Keele University. If you enjoyed this episode but you haven't yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. If you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.